you have been suspicious if a young boy that you knew was delivering the paper to your grandmother? I mean, would you be suspicious that someone like that would take and end her life for a few dollars?
Hello there, listeners and viewers. This is Ron Stefanski with yet another episode of Disrupt Ed, where we talk to the seemingly ordinary people who are out there making an extraordinary impact. And let me just tell you this. I am so grateful and so blessed to have a special guest on the show today who you're going to be hearing a lot about and you're going to be hearing more from. But first, I have to say I am grateful to John Valverde, the CEO of Youth Build, for joining me on my birthday to have a really kicking show today. So, John, thank you and welcome to Disrupt Ed.
Thank you so much for having me and happy birthday.
Thank you. So we're going to get right started, and I'm going to just warn those of you who are listening and viewing this. This is going to be a powerful and somewhat dramatic episode. We're going to be talking about some tough issues here. So let me set the groundwork for that. 2 months before I became a father for the first time in my life, I experienced tragedy on an epic level. My grandmother, a Polish immigrant who'd moved to Detroit and became the classic Rosie the Riveter, lived in a small bungalow on the east side of Detroit, raised me after my mother died when I was a child, and she was murdered in broad daylight in that home on the east side of Detroit. As I came to learn more about her story, the disaster unfolded in real time right before my eyes. And it was difficult and traumatizing, to say the least. My entire world had cratered and simply turned upside down. Out of that experience, though, you learn some things about yourself and others. And I learned that by invoking the powerful memory of my grandmother, I was able to forge a life of purpose. I had been in the education sector throughout my career, and my grandmother's murder gave me an opportunity to double down. And why do I say that? Because the person who killed her was a 14-year-old high school dropout.
The 14-year-old suspect, a white male, frail-looking. He said nothing as his attorney asked for a probable cause hearing. In the meantime, the judge said he will be held without bond.
So what we're going to talk about are things that you cannot unsee. And John Valverde, the head of Youth Build, has created a national movement for the retraining and development and opportunity creation of our lost, formerly incarcerated, and at-risk youth and young adults. He is a powerful advocate for them on a national and global scale. And so John has his own personal story about second chances that I'd like, John, for you to share with our listening and viewing audience.
Absolutely, Ron. Again, hearing the story about your grandmother, just again, I'm sorry for that loss, but grateful to see how you've turned that around. And you know, I'll start by, some people ask me, where does your Youth Build story begin? And I guess you could say that about different things in your life, you know. But I have to say, you know, I was raised by a single mom in New York City, struggling to make ends meet. You know, we depended on the support of family and friends, and we're really grateful for that. I'm first generation born in the United States. My family immigrated from Costa Rica, and also the first in my family to go to college at the time. And I had really journeyed through a lot of struggle, but I had come out the other side. Had a full scholarship to go to college, wanted to be a doctor, the one that runs out onto the field when a player is injured and repair that knee and get them back out there playing again. And, you know, I really thought my life was on a very positive trajectory after all I had been through. But when I was 21 years old, my girlfriend at the time was raped. And in my anger and anguish over what happened to her, I went and confronted the man who raped her, and I killed him. I ended up in a highly publicized trial in New York City. It turns out my victim had been a serial rapist in New York. And so it was a highly publicized case, and one in which I heard over and over again that I had done the world a service and I had done nothing wrong. And, you know, and part of you, especially at that age, that's the same age as Yukbill's young people, you don't want to believe that you're a horrible person. You don't want to believe that you were capable of something so terrible and taking a person's life. So a big part of me embraced that and really struggled with it. And I ended up being sentenced to 30 years in prison, of which I would have to serve a minimum of 10 years before I would be eligible for parole. And early on in my incarceration, I reconnected with my father. I had been a bit estranged from him for some time. He had remarried and had his new family. And I really pushed against that and struggled with that growing up. But I reconnected with him while I was in prison. And he said to me, accept full responsibility for what you did. Seek to make amends and say yes as much as you can to help others, and you will find purpose and meaning and be free. I wasn't sure what he meant, Ron. You know, I just knew that I wanted a relationship with my father. And so I put one foot in front of the other, and one day at a time, I said yes as much as I could. And I think my father understood, in a world like a maximum security prison like Sing Sing, where this conversation happened, my father knew that I was one of the few, you know, maybe 1% in the prison system that had some college education. And he knew that my yes would have the ability to contribute to the lives of others. And I continue to live today by that mantra that my father shared with me. And he passed away in 2005, 3 years before I was released from prison. But I know that my father died knowing that I was already free, because I had committed my life to serving others and making a difference in the world.
Well, John, you make every day an incredible difference. And you and I have, off camera, shared a lot about our interesting paths and the way in which they connect. And I think, you know, let's start out with killing someone, you know, themselves, that incident on its own. You know, you had a lot of people telling you that it might be justified. And I can tell you from my own experience, I remember going into the courtroom for the arraignment of this 14-year-old, and I called my boss from the car, and I said, you know, I'm not sure I'm comfortable going into that room. And he said, why? And I said, because I think I'll get to that kid before anyone else does, and I think I have so much anger right now that I'll kill him. And he didn't know me all that well at the time. We were new working with each other. And he said, you know, you're not going to do that. And I said, how do you know that? And he said, well, I'm going to tell you something that you're going to remember 30 years from now. He said, you're not going to kill him or even attempt to. In fact, you're going to forgive him. And I just lost it at that point. And the, you know, the adjectival superlatives let loose and the F-bombs and everything. I said, you don't know what you're talking about. He said, no, I do. He said, you're going to actually not only leave that kid alone, but you're going to forgive him. And the reason why you're going to do that is because your grandmother already did. And I just stopped short, because in that statement, I recognized an essential truth about all this, that somehow I would find the way to forgive, because I knew in my heart he was right. As soon as he said it, I knew he was right. But, you know, John, I want to pivot to a connection point that you and I have that's fairly strong around the issue of sexual assault. It was years before I ever admitted publicly in telling my grandmother's story that she had actually been raped by this 14-year-old. And I have since concluded that this was a point of dissension for my father and I. We could not talk about this. My family and I could not talk about this. And I have concluded from that experience that Men are wired in our DNA to protect the women we love and adore. And when someone is raped, when a woman is raped, we lose our sense of our fundamental DNA generated powers to protect the women in our lives. And I think I understand very well the reaction that you may have had in that moment. And you've since said, you know, you regret it and you've come to redefine your purpose of life because of it. But do you think there's some truth in that, that somehow that's a trigger for, you know, seeing rage and not seeing an answer other than through violence and through the ending that that man took, and especially in light of the fact that he was a serial rapist? I mean, we're, you know, I think it's a very difficult thing to talk about forgiving and letting go of people who do depraved, horrible things on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, Ron, I mean, what a topic, right? And the way these things impact and ripple through so many lives. And I would say absolutely, even culturally, being from Costa Rica and a Latino upbringing, you know, we're supposed to be the macho and masculine and protectors of our family, et cetera. So even though I grew up in New York City, that was certainly part of my upbringing. And I specifically in this case, also the fact that the person I loved, you know, had been violated in this way, and that I couldn't protect her, and that I had even taken her there the day that this happened, not knowing, you know, what would result, of course. But the other thing to say too, and I know that we have a connection on this point, is that while maybe all of us at the age of 21 think we've got life figured out and we know everything that we need to do, et cetera, you know, the truth is, and we know this now, our brains are not fully formed and developed until age 25 or so. My inability to manage my emotions, even though I had a full scholarship, did well in school, honor roll, all of those things, the intellect and the emotional side of a young person, and in, of course, we're speaking about me, I just couldn't navigate it. I didn't have the ability, the skills, the tools, the mechanisms to really manage the situation in any other way. And while I will always say that, you know, I didn't like plan this out in any way, I was angry enough to hurt this person. But I must say, I wasn't thinking about maybe the 2,000 victims that he had. I was only thinking about one. And of course, the disrespect I felt as well. I need to acknowledge that, you know, that there's a big part of these crimes that I didn't do it for my girlfriend. I did it for me. And that's a big part of accepting responsibility and expressing remorse for what I did. I know that what I did is wrong. I just didn't have the tools to manage this in any other way. And I'll say this to you, and I don't speak about faith very much openly and publicly, but you know, now, many years later, my crime happened 33 years ago. All these years later, there's a part of me that wonders if, yes, maybe someone did need to stop this person, and it was going to need to be someone who would survive the incarceration and the consequences of a horrible decision like the one I made, and someone who could maybe make it out the other side and contribute to the world and really truly have a lifelong redemptive journey that makes a difference. And I'm really humbled to even say that out loud. And I wonder sometimes, you know, if that is true, but maybe God knew that I would make it somehow and that I'd do good with my life afterwards.
You know, I think that's a powerful statement and one that I certainly completely identify with. I remember on the day of my grandmother's funeral, One of our close family friends came up from Mexico, actually, in Merida to officiate at her funeral. And he told a story about this gentle figure, Christ, who was doing all these amazing things. He was hanging out with, tax cheats and prostitutes and all that. And he said, you know, the interesting thing is when you hear about all these things, you say, wow, that's just too good to be true. Who doesn't want to emulate that? And in point of fact, we didn't emulate that. People at the time chose to turn on him. And I think that's the story of redemption. And I think that's the story and the arc of our story together that comes full circle. We both had a full circle moment, both as we prepared for this show, but also in life. We prepared to say, how do we move past and beyond? And the fact of the matter is, we cannot unsee things that happened of a great nature, but we can create a new path forward that owns that moment, but transforms it into something good. And there is no one, John, that I know personally that doesn't work harder at changing that narrative more than you. And I've known you now for 10 years and have watched you do this work that you do. And I want to talk more about that because you've dedicated your life not simply to running a national nonprofit organization of some size and scope, but you really get into the weeds with those you're trying to serve. And so I want you to have an opportunity here to share a little bit more about the Youth Build story because you're such a part of it. But you've also ushered in this massive movement to say, you know what? We're not leaving any of these people behind. And you know what? We're not going to be glib and we're not going to be superficial about the challenge. We know that many of these folks that we're trying to help are not going to be able to make that kind of change, but we're going to persist. We're going to keep going at it because we don't know any better and we don't know any differently. And we're just going to keep doing it. And guess what? Years later, you and I are both in the enviable position of saying we didn't get them all, but we brought a bunch of them with us. You know, and so I'd like you to talk a little bit about that because your life did change that day forward. And it's a very powerful recipe for purpose and passion and change.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. I think. Because of this conversation and our conversations, you know, I've been reflecting on that point, that very beginning of my incarceration. And I can tell you, I thought my life was over. I didn't think that I would survive 10 days, let alone 10 years to get to parole. And I didn't never imagine that I could find meaning and purpose inside a maximum security prison. So
you
know, hopefully we'll have a chance. Yeah,
hopefully we'll have
a chance to share a bit more about my experience inside.
Right. So inside, one of the things you did is you started a college program for colleagues in prison right along with you. I mean, you did not sit on your hands and say, I don't know how I'm going to get through this and just passively. I mean, you fought your way through those years by getting outside of yourself, frankly, and getting, you know, and looking at how you could help others. And I think that's probably the most powerful recipe for transformation and change is not focusing on ourselves, but focusing on the livelihoods of others and those we can serve.
That's absolutely it. You know, so many of us speak about hitting rock bottom. And if you hit rock bottom, the only way is up. Well, a lot of people can't get up and a lot of people can't make their way forward. And surviving 16 years in prison from age 21 to 38 to becoming the first formally incarcerated CEO of a nonprofit with a global mission that you go global. It is humbling. It is humbling the life that I've been able, given the opportunity to live, the opportunity to lead, the opportunity to contribute to the lives of young people. So I just want to, you know, I know hopefully we'll have many future conversations about all of these pieces, but I want to really thank you for giving me the opportunity to share a little bit about what's giving me hope and meaning and purpose today, well, 33 years after my incarceration. Last year made 16 years home after serving 16 years in prison, which is a huge milestone. A lot of people don't make it either home free, or alive for many health reasons, accelerated aging due to incarceration and trauma, etc. But Youth Build stands with, partners with young people aged 16 to 24 who are not in school and not working to build the skill sets and mindsets they need for lifelong learning, livelihood, and leadership. So a differentiating factor for Youth Build is that we operate at the nexus of three spheres: positive youth development, education, and workforce and career readiness and credentials, right? So that is unique in the world. We're also a network.
That's very unique in the world.
We're also a network that operates in rural, suburban, urban, and tribal settings, you know, both here in the United States and eight other countries outside the U.S. currently. And we have 335 sites now. I'm certainly humbled by the number of sites, but most importantly, the incredible work they do on the front lines, on the ground every day. Youth Build Global, the organization I lead, is the headquarters, the support center, the partner to these 335 sites, but they are the ones engaging young people directly. And you'll get this quick point, but last week I was in Chicago, you know, and I in New Jersey the week before, and I get to travel and visit so many Youth Build sites to be with young people who have made the choice, the decision to change their lives and see Youth Build as the opportunity to live out that transformation and gain the skills and complete their high school and gain employment and really see a future for themselves that they never imagined were possible. I mean, that's a joy to me. It fills my cup, my heart every time. And I have to say, equally, meeting the staff who love these young people, believe in them, support them, encourage them, push them with high expectations. You know, aren't these all the elements that all of us hope that we have growing up? Well, Youth Build's young people often don't have all of that when they're growing up.
They don't
up.
Have any of that in exactly. some cases. You know, I think you're Absolutely. Raising a very, very important point, and that is upon reflection, I've come to recognize that we do not, as a country and as a society, have a really good bead on a whole generation of young people out there who have been cast adrift. And I refer to them as feral children. I mean, they've been left to the streets. They've been left without infrastructure of family or people operating as family, whether biologically or otherwise. And so they've been left to roam. And as a consequence, bad things happen. And what I find so remarkable and so uplifting about your story, John, is you refuse to let them linger that way. You refuse to say, I can't help them. I can't. I must find a way to help them, to bring them in, to keep trying, to keep going at it, because change on this level is so extraordinary and so difficult. We shared off camera that I have a little brother through the Big Brothers organization, and that I took him on at the age of 14, and I did so intentionally because I had been doing a lot of this work helping young people and opportunity youth to get a high school credential and then move back into a pathway of prosperity. And I'd felt like I had, when we had our high school program adapted by Walmart and McDonald's and Hilton, I felt like, wow, I've been able to have some impact on thousands of people. But the question I had was, can I impact one person? And so I was matched with young Renard Robinson. And Renard, as you're listening, I hope you're hearing every bit of this, because John and I are going to have you on this show at some point to tell your unique story. But Renard, I found in an agitated state of anger. He had just lost his father at the age of 38 to a heart attack. And then a month or so later, his grandfather, his second role model, committed suicide upon learning that he had early onset dementia. And so Renard had two male figures that went away in his life, and he became very angry. And so through a tiger mom that wouldn't say no and wouldn't leave him behind. She got him not only through school, but into a very highly rated private collegiate prep academy, De La Salle Jesuit, and he went there, and then he went to college. But, you know, when he got to college, his second year, he kind of reverted back to a lot of things that he knew about in his past in the city, in that sort of traumatic upbringing where he lost sight of the Gold Coast. And he started having difficulties in school and with money and things. And, you know, we had a lot of conversations because I share your view that we cannot let go. It's like pulling them out of this deep vortex. We just can't let our grip go. You know, we just have to remain holding them and bringing them into the light. And in Renard's case, it wasn't through me. It was through his own self-determination that he's made some powerful changes in his life. In the course of the last year, he's lost over 200 pounds. He's a gentle giant. He was 520 pounds when he went to college. He's now 320. He decided to become financially independent. So we worked on that for the first couple of his semesters, and we looked at the way he was spending money and made changes there, healthy lifestyle changes. And I said, you know, Renard, you should try to see if you can save $200 to $300 in the semester, and you'll be surprised at what kind of impact that'll have on your own ability to see things differently. And he came home last week and shared with me that his bank account had over $3,000 saved. And I said, what does that mean to you? And he said, it means that I can start planning for things beyond the here and now, that I don't have to look simply right in front of me. I can say, I want something. It's going to take time, or it's going to take an extraordinary effort, and I won't see it for a while, but I can still keep my eye on it and move forward. And I thought, wow, this is a 21-year-old who's really making that turn, just as you did, John, during your time, when you were called to make that change.
No, he's so fortunate to have you. That's in your support. But I love what you said about his self-determination too. I think we partner with, we stand with them, but the journey is theirs.
It is theirs.
We're just grateful to be part of the journey.
That's correct. And the other thing you learn, and you learned this at Youth Build, John, and you've been the example of this for me. You know, you said you went there to help people and to create purpose. But those people that you work with, just as I work with Renard, they're the ones that give way more to us than we give to them. I certainly feel that way, and I know you do as well. It's really important to say, wow, when you encounter people in the presence, in the present, and they are struggling, but they are poised and ready to take on a tough new journey, at self-actualization and self-discovery and self-growth. I think that to me, John, is the powerful distinction that Youth Build makes among all other organizations out there, is they simply don't let go of their grip until someone is on that path.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I would just say, this is really important. You know, our young people are the same as all young people. Right. All young people have gifts and talents and intellect, you know, in equal measure. They just don't have the same access to opportunity. Our young people had to make choices at a young age that prevented them from completing their high school, prevented them from pursuing a career or even thinking about a career. They're surviving and making ends meet and trying to care for support their single mom, for example, the ways I did too. You know, but you're absolutely right. Our young people, all of us want to be on a path of economic mobility. The story you just shared, $3,000 in the bank and the freedom of choice that gives him. You know, all of us want that for ourselves and for others. Youth Build's young people are not even on the path, don't even know about the path to economic mobility. So Youth Build being a place that, number one, as you said, never lets go, wants to be there and ensure that the success of this young person
we're often the first place. Really, it's not even just second chance program. It is. But it's often a first chance program for our young people who are getting exposed to what is possible for them for the first time in their lives. Not because they didn't, many of them do have love and people who care about them. But again, those folks are limited in their resources too and in their ability to support. So youth build complements. And that's why I love that we agree, we partner with, we stand with these young people who've made the choice to take on life in a different way and shift what is possible for their generation and the next generation and their families and their communities. So it's I'm really excited to be talking with you about Youth Build and how all these journeys come together.
Well, you know, John, every time we get on the phone or every time we get on a show, I have to say I have a really hard time getting off. Because I could listen to you talk about this stuff for a long time. And what we're going to do to our listening and viewing audience, you've been listening to John Valverde talk about the powerful origin story that led him to lead a global movement for those off the path to get back on the path toward youth development, leadership, and lifelong learning. And we're going to come back for an episode 2 here because I have so many more questions for you, John. And we also have an exciting announcement to make in episode 2. So come back for it, will you? Thanks.